Comics. An important part of our early literature were the children's comics. The first one was more of the Janet and John variety, called Jack and Jill, and the only characters I remember were Harold Hare and Dickie Dormouse. But I soon graduated to the Eagle comic, with a wonderful cover story of Dan Dare, pilot of the future, with his adventures in space. This was much more exciting, and having obtained a reprinted Christmas album book recently, I realised how educational it was, with detailed exploded technical drawings of ships, planes and power stations. Other educational articles would include advice on caring for pets and explanations, often complex in their detail, on topics such as weather forecasting. In trying to jog distant memories of the contents, I've retrieved the Eagle annual reprint that I bought relatively recently. Its contents are quite a revelation. Firstly, there are adverts for sweets and toys, which isn't so surprising, but also ads for raincoats, boys' shirts and hairbrushes. There are also career-based propaganda, such as the joys of a career as a civil engineer, and a detailed description of weather forecasting that, if you had a comprehensive absorption of, would easily get a senior appointment on the TV weather staff, assuming you could also do the elaborate hand jive moves that now seem to be most critical qualification. I vaguely recall there were competitions, and I think I did once submit a coloured drawing into one, unsuccessfully. More revelatory are the reprinted articles such as I Became a Knife Thrower's Target by Eagle's special investigator, the late MacDonald Hastings. I'm joking about the late, as he obviously survived to tell the tale. He was also, reluctantly I should think, the author of the memorable I Became a Living Firework in an asbestos suit. Other encouragements to dangerous pursuits included ads for air rifles, catapults and boomerangs, plus use a pin to discover where you feel pain in a science snippet. Another page shows instructions on dismantling a household tap to replace the washer and stop it dripping. I'm pretty sure I did not spend my childhood being bothered by dripping taps, but can see that a more neurotic and organised child would find this appealing. Possibly one already seduced by the idea of a career as a civil engineer and now anxious to acquire useful skills in that area. A reprint that would certainly catch the eye of an inquisitive boy is a short article entitled Man About the House, Smash the Crockery? Then Mend It. This had elaborate descriptions of gluing together broken shards and supporting them with string tourniquets. Now this is all very well, but call me suspicious. The title is not Smashed Crockery, but Smashed the Crockery, which implies some active participation in the damage. I can just imagine little Johnny left to his own devices on a wet afternoon in the dining room next to the dresser with the priceless family china heirlooms, mother out of sight upstairs engaged in some household chore. A thought comes to him. What was that intriguing article in my Eagle comic this week? I think you can see the temptation. Given a clearly overdeveloped confidence by the publishers in the ability of their young readers to use prudence in copying such exhortations to live in dangerously, it's no surprise that one edition carried an explanation of how the inclusion of advertising subsidised the cover price. A clear indication that the 1 million or so young weekly readers were a highly sophisticated bunch and would appreciate such gems of modern finance in amongst the daring tales of space, Scotland Yard, and the French Foreign Legion. I do remember my sense of acquisitiveness being stimulated by two such ads. The first was a Dan Dare radio station, complete with two walkie-talkies, impressive dials and buttons, and a rotating searchlight. The console was topped with two impressive antennae, like two miniature electricity pylons, and was set up for Morse code or voice communication. I don't recall the price, but suspect it was beyond several months' savings of pocket money, and perhaps the ad was not featured around the autumn when birthday or Christmas presents could be deployed. I was never to own one, and although years later I saw one in an antique shop, it seemed a lot to pay for a plastic box with a few lights, and there was no certainty that it was capable of interplanetary communication. I've since discovered through reminiscences with an old school friend that he still has one in his loft. Get that set on eBay, Cledwin. Liquidate the asset before it's too late. I did at one time have sufficient funds to send away for another wonder of modern technology, a microscope that displayed images on a screen. The 13 and 6, or whatever, was duly sent off, probably in postal orders and stamps, and I ambushed the postman for several weeks, despite reminders that the ad said dispatch may take up to 28 days. No amount of argument with my mum about the detail of these terms would persuade me that the arrival of this wonder of technology wasn't imminent. Unfortunately, when the long-awaited device arrived, one day when I was at school, the house had to be scoured for the right batteries. Two large ones, possibly from the doorbell or my dad's torch, and it proved a little disappointing. Firstly, the light thrown through a mirror onto the screen was rather dim, even in a darkened room. The image was pretty grainy, and it seemed less powerful than my original microscope, which was powered by sunlight, which I'd rashly passed on to my little brother, declaring it as redundant technology. I don't think it lasted any longer than one set of batteries, and the novelty of seeing water fleas in pond water or the blurred hairs on the leg of a dead fly wore off pretty quickly. I was not destined for a career in science, but I had learned a costly lesson on the power of advertising. There was also a blatant object lesson on the sins employed by advertisers in those faraway days. A full-page picture shows an ecstatic boy sitting in a racing car some 6 foot in length, brandishing a packet of sugar puffs bearing the slogan, "Free Inside, Model Racing Car." Described in the text as looking like the real thing, in the corner of the page was a much smaller picture with a caption of a single-coloured plastic car, which experience would teach you is what you get. But it seems rather unfair to expect the average ambitious and optimistic 8 or 9 year old to expect this crappy piece of plastic in lieu of the full-size car his contemporary is shown sitting in. Never mind the question of how the car would be fitted inside the cereal box and still allow some room at least for some sugar puffs. This was the era of nuclear power and Sputniks in space and chocolates advertised with less fattening centres. A certain amount of gullibility was to be expected. The comic also carried hints on building your own spaceport using biro tubes and discarded tins and cardboard tubes. But my artistic abilities or lack of patience didn't match the picture in the comic when it was finished, and these attempts were soon abandoned. The Eagle comic was unknowingly particularly formative for me in an unexpected direction. It was the first place in one of their history articles that I learned several facts about the island of Crete. Fact 1, it was occupied in the Second World War by the German army in the first mass attack by paratroopers. Secondly, the ancient palace at Knossos was unearthed by the British archaeologist Arthur Evans, and he named the civilization the Minoans after the Greek legend of the Minotaur and the maze. These were the only two things I knew about Crete when many years later, research for a summer holiday came up with Crete as a destination. It was such a successful holiday that we returned on a number of occasions, eventually buying a small stone village house for renovation as our holiday home. The story of that adventure is told in my book for sale on Amazon, A Small House in Crete. A further rather spooky coincidence is that the previous occupant of the house was named Anastasia, which is also the name of Dander's spaceship. So the Eagle comic has been truly influential in my life. Also proof that the early lesson in the power of subtle or otherwise advertising was not lost on me. A recent obituary this autumn recorded the passing at the age of 94 of one of the original illustrators of the Eagle comic, a lady called Greta Tomlinson, who was reputed to be the inspiration for Professor Jocelyn Peabody, first appearing in the fifth Dan Dare story, and subsequently making regular appearances in the comic and providing a useful female role model for girls to follow science studies in those less egalitarian times. There were other comics available, but these were usually seen in friends' houses or in waiting rooms. I think there was also a supply in junior school for wet play days, relatively frequently in South Wales. The favourites were the Beano and the Dandy. arguably less intellectual than the Eagle comic, but containing stories of the adventures of the giants of children's literature, such as Dennis the Menace, Beryl the Peril, Roger the Dodger, and the less poetic Lord Snooty and the Bash Street Gang, or Corky the Cat. I still think of Dennis's beloved shaggy dog Gnasher when I see a particularly black hairy dog, and can only just resist asking the owner if he's called Gnasher. You have to take your fun where you can get it. The Second World War. Though old enough to qualify as vulnerable through age during the recent pandemic and subsequent vaccination programme, I'm not old enough to have first-hand knowledge of the Second World War. But the dramatic events were recent and traumatic enough to form part of society's collective conscience in my early years. The comics contained war stories and glowing tributes to Winston Churchill and the likes of national heroes such as Douglas Bader and Field Marshal Montgomery. It must be remembered that by the time I had acquired conscious memory, say the mid-1950s, wartime was just a decade away. So it's similar to the time span since the 2012 London Olympics or the banking crash, events of much less significance in the public experience. It was not surprising that wartime stories were common currency for 50s conversations, and events were often described as before the war or in wartime. There was also tangible evidence all around, bomb sites where there were sometimes gaps in terraces of houses, or large, inexplicable craters now filled with brambles and buddleia plants. School playgrounds still contained air raid shelters, and there were roadside concrete pillboxes and tank traps. Undoubtedly, it was a once-in-a-generation collective trauma, so it shouldn't be surprising that wartime cast such a long shadow and strongly figured in comics, films and childhood games, as well as adult conversations, which we would eagerly overhear. It was also quite common for pieces of discarded military hardware to be used as playthings. Smelly, rubbery gas masks, thankfully with the asbestos filters removed, usually. These were dangerous times. Also military binoculars, compasses and even bayonets and knives. I was the proud owner of my granddad's air raid warden's tin helmet with ARP stenciled in white paint on the front. Unfortunately, it was so large and heavy for my small young head and neck that it only had ceremonial purpose, and wearing it for any length of time gave me a very sore neck, and its looseness and heavy weight made it impractical for any active boyhood reenactments. More useful was an impressive large metal compass, which had a lid that contained a sighting device, and my brother shared with me, as well as a pair of powerful army-issued binoculars that had been split to give us half each. Any such collections were trumped in magnificent fashion during a visit to a school friend's house, where he showed me the play den that he had at the bottom of his garden that he shared with his brother, a Messerschmitt fighter cockpit cover in metal and glass, ideal for Battle of Britain play. Where the hell did they get that? I later became aware of the German bubble cars, one of which was a Messerschmitt, so it was more likely that the cover was from the car, as it was made by the same company. But it was a dangerous time, so who knows? Family. I've mentioned my family, and certainly in childhood they assume a greater importance during your early years. My mother's family seemed to have a military background, and although I haven't indulged in the tracing my ancestors' activities, there are details that I remember from being told firsthand by my parents. My mother was born in Chatham, Kent, but that seemed almost coincidental, as my grandfather was a regimental sergeant major in the Royal Engineers, and I believe that's where the family was stationed at that time, January 1922. My grandfather had been born in Cardiff, but I believe my grandmother was from Devon. Mum was the youngest of five, along with her twin brother, Douglas. There's a photo in the book showing them seated on the left with my mother's elder brothers as a baby. I believe she's yet to be born, and the others in the photo are a mystery to me. Their surname was Gale, and not long after her birth, the family was part of the Royal Engineers garrison on the island of Jamaica in the Caribbean, where they stayed for the late 1920s and the early 1930s. They came back to Britain for the twins' secondary education. Photos of that time show an idyllic childhood with palm trees, verandas in the sun, and pony riding. There is even a photo of the family with a car, captioned Our Ford, and they seem to have owned a number of horses. I'm told that the life of a regimental sergeant major would be relatively privileged, and the photos seem to confirm this. Certainly their standard of living would be more comfortable than they would have enjoyed in 1920s Britain. The photo album suggests that they were living near Newcastle in the Blue Mountains, some 15 miles from Kingston, the capital, although Cedar Valley is also a caption on some of the photos. This is described as being a British military post from 1840 to 1959. The location in the mountain area was a defence against yellow fever that had previously been a serious problem to garrisons stationed in Jamaica. It must have been quite adventurous for my grandparents to decide to take their young family there. My mum was always pleased if we spotted a mango or an avocado at the greengrocer's, a relative rarity in Wales in the 1950s, and she made us jealous talking of sugar canes and pineapples in their garden. Fortunately, my mum kept the family photo album of their time there, and a fascinating record it makes. It must have been a great childhood experience, and the photos record the family in Havana as well as their time in Jamaica. The time in Jamaica must have been close to idyllic for my mum at a young age, with four brothers as company and horses, puppies and the sun and the sea. She always spoke fondly about her happy memories of their time there. Certainly the photos show them all enjoying themselves, and it must have been quite an adaptation returning to England in the depressed 1930s leading up to the war years. I'm hazy about the timescale, and my mum talked of living back in Wales, although photos show her in a Bars Hill, Coventry girls' grammar school uniform, and I know that the family lived in Coventry during the war, when my granddad had the unenviable task of an air raid warden. She also talked of bringing a parrot back with them from Jamaica, and the photo of my granny with one confirms the story. The parrot was called Polly, and later reminiscences will confirm a theme. My mum saw wartime service in the WAF, the Women's Air Service of the RAF, and was a non-commissioned officer, a corporal, serving from September 1941 to March 1946. Sadly, I don't recall many details about what mum told me about her wartime service, or possibly, like many children, I didn't pay much attention to her telling of it. I do remember her complaining that she wasn't eligible for a more adventurous overseas posting because she already had her four brothers serving overseas. She mentioned being stationed in Gloucester and possibly St Athens. Her RAF service and release book contains some interesting details, such as the page mentioning the return and disposal of the WAF greatcoat and the fact that the princely sum of £1.10 would be received in return. There's also a section showing a stamp for encashment of postal drafts for clothing allowance for the amount of £12.10. There are details of a travel warrant and a stamp for food rations after leaving the service, which seems to suggest she travelled from Birmingham to Neath. I know she was living in Neath with my grandparents after the war, and I have a reference letter stating that she left employment at the town clerk's office in February 1949, after getting married a year earlier and moving to Swansea with my dad. It's like piecing together a jigsaw puzzle of connected parts of my parents' life. To some extent, my father's earlier life is a little clearer, as it was all spent until he left school in the town of Swansea. I know he grew up in a house in the Uplands, the same house that my grandparents were living in after I was born, and I used to visit them there. He was one of three children, having an elder brother and a sister. His father, Bob, is described as a salesman on my parents' marriage certificate, and I believe he worked at the large Swansea department store of Ben Evans, which was destroyed by bombing in the war. I know little of my dad's school days, although he went to a secondary school, not a grammar school, and was in the Swansea Sea Scouts and left school at the age of 14 and joined the Merchant Navy. He later worked as an office boy in the local newspaper offices, and after wartime service, he returned to Swansea and worked in the costing office of Unit Superheater Works on the Strand. And I also remember talk of jobs being held open after the interlude of wartime service for those fortunate enough to safely return. While I was young, Dad studied at night school, qualifying as a chartered company secretary, making up for his lack of earlier education. I'm trying to reconstruct those years, along with my memories of Dad mentioning going to South America and the Cape of South Africa before the war. Wartime service must have been traumatic, with being evacuated from the beach at Dunkirk, then being deployed in Egypt and North Africa. The campaign through Italy was followed by a time in the occupying army in Palestine. Sadly, I have no comprehensive record of any of this, only some photo albums and collections of postcards. I know that after joining up and being posted to France, it was not until 1946, some 6 years later, that he returned to a Swansea that he did not recognise, with the town centre having been largely destroyed by German bombing. Coming out of the railway station, he completely lost his bearings as he could see St Mary's Church to the south, when it should have been obscured by the large building of Ben Evans department store. He was confused as to which direction to take to get to the uplands because of the radically changed landscape. I guess that the extent of the damage from the bombing had been kept from family members serving overseas, either out of the need to hide bad news at home or due to strict censorship in wartime. I do remember being told that my parents met in a dance studio in Walters Road having dancing lessons, presumably my mum having come from Neath and my dad now back at work in Swansea. They were married on March 27, 1948, in the Church of St David in Neath. I waited for the 1950s to begin before I joined them in the world. Stout Hall. I was told by my parents that I was born in Gower, and my birth certificate confirms this. In the years after the war, a large house in its spacious grounds off the South Gower Road towards Port Einan was used as a maternity ward, perhaps as an overflow to Swansea's hospital in the town centre, and of personal significance as the site of my tonsils removal. Stout Hall was some 15 miles from the town and my parents' home, and my dad said that the bus ride of almost an hour down dark country lanes for the evening visiting hours was quite an ordeal, although I think I'm absolved of any blame for this. Car trips into Gower in adult life were often punctuated with my comment of, "See that house?" pointing through a gateway at a gloomy distant building down a drive and surrounded by tall trees full of crows. I was born there. It was once pointed out to me that I remained remarkably cheerful after such an unpromising start. In recent years, upon returning to live again in Wales after a long absence, I had the opportunity to return to my actual birthplace. Unbeknown to me, my wife had found out that although the house and grounds were now an outward bound style education centre, they'd started a pop-up restaurant and took bookings when the centre was not being used by students. So one autumn evening found me being driven out to supper in a mystery destination in Gower. As I'd not heard of the occasional restaurant facilities, I was mildly surprised to be driven through the entrance gates and up the drive to the house that I'd left at a very tender age, some 60 plus years earlier, never anticipating to return. We were welcomed into a large reception hall with a stone floor and a sweeping, steep, curving staircase to the floors above. The owner led us through a room he described as the library and offered us a welcoming drink, and went away to bring menus for us. On his return, he explained that the chef and kitchen staff normally catered for large student parties with hearty food after vigorous outdoor activities, such as surfing, orienteering and sea kayaking, etc. The chef had recently offered to do some small evening dinner parties with a more adventurous menu than his usual fare. Certainly the menu reflected this, with local seafood dishes and Gower vegetables, but my appetite whetting was interrupted by the question, "Have you been to Stout Hall before?" When I explained the background to my only previous visit, he got quite animated and explained that earlier in the year, they'd entertained a party of retired nurses and midwives who had been able to describe how the house was set up when it was a maternity hospital. Then the shock question, "Would you like to see the room you were born in?" Whilst not actually being sure that I did, Nevertheless, I found us following him up the staircase and going through a doorway off the long corridor landing into a small room with a set of bunk beds. The retired nurses told me this was the birthing room, he stated even passively. I was feeling more emotional, although I wasn't really sure why. After a short silent contemplation and perhaps sensing a certain unease, at least on my part, he led us down the corridor and explained the large ward room had been subdivided in later years, but at the time of my arrival there would be a ward of a dozen or so beds where the mothers would spend up to a week before being allowed home. As we made our way down the steep staircase, he relayed a final disturbing fact that in those days new mums were discouraged from too much exertion, so the mother would be wheeled down the staircase in a wheelchair, holding the newborn on their lap. Looking at the precipitous stairs and the hard hall floor, I concluded that I'd been lucky to make it safely out of there. Somewhat chastened, we went into the dining room and enjoyed an excellent dinner. At least my appetite hadn't suffered.